You're listening to On Margins. I'm Craig Maad, and this is episode 5. Cocky.org is a website. It is not an app. It is not a product. It is simply a static website, updated daily, running some rickety old blogging software. As of March 2018, it's been consistently updated for 20 years. It is largely the product of a single mind, Jason Cocky. Cocky.org has shaped the way many of us have thought about news, blogging, and linking. Jason has built his entire career around the power of hypertext. That is, he has pointed to things and added commentary in over 26,000 posts. A simple gesture, and today an obvious one, but one that was only possible because of how the web was constructed. Everything on the web sits side by side as equal class citizens. So, a guy in a bedroom in the middle of nowhere can stand toe-to-toe with global news agencies. And through a consistency of tone, hopefulness, and sharp eye, Cocky.org has stood the test of time. It's one of the largest, longest-running, single-proprietor websites online. Now, not all books are bound, and not all books need be printed on paper. In my estimation, Cocky.org is as much a book, that is, a distillation of a singular, curious point of view, as any thick nonfiction tome published today. Jason was kind enough to make time to chat with me about this and more on today's episode. I hope you enjoy. Jason, thank you for being here today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me, Craig.
If you were to go back in time and thank one person or one institution that has allowed you to do what you're doing today, who would that be?
I mean, I think there's a few contenders. I grew up on a farm and then a small town in rural Wisconsin. And, you know, this was the 80s and early 90s. And so I was very culturally sheltered. I didn't know a whole lot about what was going on in the wider world. But I did well at school and I got a scholarship to a college in Iowa called Coe College. And I went, and, you know, college for me was sort of this eye-opening experience, you know, like it is for a lot of people. But I think for me, it was like I kind of discovered that I was always a super curious kid and super interested in science and learning. Like, I actually liked school. Like, I liked the learning part of school. I hated the social part of school, but the learning part of school was great.
Right.
When I got to college, it was like, holy shit, there are people here who take that part of school seriously, you know, because they're curious about it, because they kind of can't help it. And I sort of learned that I'm one of those people that I just can't help being interested in all sorts of different things. And, you know, college for me was like this amazing thing, and didn't know what I was going to major in when I got there. But after a year or two, I decided I was going to major in physics. And I had this advisor, his name was Dr. Feller, and he was the best teacher, hands down, I've ever had in my entire life. And he would do this amazing thing. And I didn't know this sort of right away, but, you know, when I got to be a junior and senior, I noticed this more and more. Like, in the class, he would teach simultaneously to every level in the class, no matter if you were, you know, you knew exactly what was going on with everything, or if you were really struggling, or anywhere in between. And I don't know how he did it. Like, I still don't know how he did it. And he was so generous with his time and his energy, and he had this infectious sort of energy that just propelled everyone forward. And I just took so much from that experience and from having him as an advisor and as a mentor, you know, and as a friend, really. Like, he became a friend, and, you know, I think I owe him a lot in how I approach the world and how I approach work and, you know, just in thinking of the world as this sort of endless bounty of things to know.
Is he still around?
He still is. Yeah. He's, I think this is his last year teaching. He's going to transition into a sort of a peer research role, working with students on research. Okay. Every 5 years, the physics department has a reunion, and this year coming up is the reunion. And I've already, I mean, I haven't bought my tickets, but I will soon. I am definitely attending. Definitely attending.
Have you ever said, hey, by the way, you know, a big part of what I'm doing today was influenced by and having you as an archetype in my life. Have you ever explicitly told him that?
I haven't, but I think I'm going to make a point of it, you know, this time around.
I only bring that up because, you know, I had two people, I think, in my childhood, too, who enabled me to get access to a kind of thinking, mm-hmm. you know, similar to what mm-hmm. you described, a kind of thinking, a kind of curiosity. But there was one person who literally just gave me access to his house because he had a computer and we couldn't afford one. When you're young, you're kind of, you don't think about death. You don't mm-hmm. think about gratitude as much as you should. At least I didn't. Maybe that's a failure of my upbringing or me as a child or whatever, but I never really thanked him. I never thanked him. In fact, it was just one day he got a new computer and I bought his old computer and then that was it. And I remember like 5 years ago going, shit, all right, I need to email Tom. And I went to look and he had passed away from a heart attack, you know, a few years before. And you just go, fuck, yeah, that's a really important thing to remember to do. A lot of times we think people know that they have had a profound impact on us. But the reality is that they don't. I think a lot of people have a tremendous influence, positive influence on folks they come in contact with, students. And they never really know how much of an impact they've had until it's explicitly said. For me, that's become an important principle of moving through the world. So that's great, though. You're lucky, you know? And it's amazing how powerful just one good person in your life can be.
Yeah, I feel lucky to have crossed paths with him and to have been, you know, so influenced by him. I think a lot of his students, you know, feel like that. I think he's far and away the most popular / the most respected teacher that school has ever had in a lot of ways. Super guy.
You have 20 years built up on the site. Have you done a calculation of how many words that is?
I did a few years ago and I can't remember what it was, but I mean, it's several books worth of stuff. You know, if I didn't do this and let's say, you know, I wrote books instead, like I would, you know, have 10, 12 books under my, you know, under my name right now.
Right.
It's a lot.
It's a ton. I mean, it's crazy. It's like to have one place where you consistently put 20 years of thinking and focus into.
Yeah. And I haven't done a lot of writing elsewhere. Like I've written one or two things for Wired, I think. And
right.
I did a thing for Mac Magazine and I did like something for Neiman Lab. And that was about it. Everything else is on Kottke.org.
I was going to ask about the .org bit. Like it feels natural. Like it feels like if it was Kottke.com. Kottke.com, even just saying it feels incorrect. It just feels wrong.
Right? Yeah.
There's no .com happening in Kottke land. But that felt like quite insightful in 1998 to pick a .org. Do you remember, was Kottke.com taken?
Oh, yeah. I would have had .com, but it was taken. Okay. So I just had to take .org. So it wasn't, it wasn't any sort of like stylistic or, you know, editorial choice. It was just like, okay, I'm going to go with .org. You know, because in the early days, only sort of organizations and like nonprofits could have .org domains. And so like when I got .org, everyone was like, well, I don't understand. Are you an org? Like, you know, it was sort of like this, can you really have this? And I'm like, well, yeah, anybody can register anything. You can register a .net even though you're not a network.
Right. This was back when TLDs had meaning. You know?
Right. It's exactly.
Like, it's like today, nothing matters. Nothing is real.
Exactly. I tweeted the other day that I was looking for a guest editor for an upcoming, you know, week. And somebody sent me an email about it and like, oh, I'm a writer here and here and here. And here's my personal URL. And it was Beyonce.horse. Like that's a URL now, you know, and a fucking great URL, but like, it's kind of crazy.
Oh my God, dude, you should hire that creature.
I looked at it and I was like, holy shit, Beyonce.horse. This is a big, you know, green check mark in my estimation. So we'll see.
I like that we're at Beyonce.horse period of the internet because it's like, it's all invented. We get so precious about the stuff. This is the proper way to do this or that or whatever. And it's like, this is all just invented stuff, like from some bearded dudes in the 60s, were just saying, well, this is a let's use .com and we're gonna do http://. That makes sense. That's a good way of doing it. Yep. I think that's a very readable way to define the protocol.
And then culture took over. You know what I mean?
Right,
and culture is things like, I'm going to do Beyonce.horse, you know?
Right. Because it's like, it doesn't matter. You know, it's like, who's typing in URLs anymore anyway?
Right.
I feel like the .org for you as like an ethos, intentional or not, it feels so fitting, right? Because it feels like Kaki.org is an organization. It's a singular voice. It is, you know, a collection of careful thinking, hopeful thinking. And that's what I want in my organizations in the world. You know, my cultural organizations is consideration and hope and curiosity. So it feels very, very fitting. But have you ever taken the Kaki.org content and done anything else with it? Has it ever manifested in any other way besides Kaki.org on the web?
No, it hasn't. I mean, I've thought about putting it on the Kindle or turning it into an actual book. Or I was talking to some friends a few years ago about making kind of a iPad sort of magazine thing out of it, where you would take articles from the website around certain topics and sort of repackage them together into these sort of magazine issues. But I don't know. Nothing really ever came of that. You know, it's still an idea that's out there. There are lots of different things I could do.
Has anyone approached you about acquiring the archive?
No.
Has a library ever come to you and said, hey, you know, in the same way that you acquire like Leonard Cohen's letters, like has anyone said, we want the Kaki.org official archives?
I think at some point, like a few years ago, the New York Public Library sent me an email about something like that they were going to do it, but then they never followed up. Okay. And I think, you know, it was one of those things where maybe like the person that was there at that time was spearheading this thing. And then it kind of like lost steam and kind of fell apart. But that was the only thing that I remember along those lines.
Right. When I think of your website or a website like yours, in my mind, it really sits as close to like a book as you can get online. It feels like there are strong edges to it. Like I kind of know where it begins and ends, even though it's 20 years and probably millions of words. I feel like even if it's not knowable in its entirety, I understand the parameters of the object. You know, I understand the parameters of the website and I understand the contract that I'm entering into when I go to Kaki.org. I think a lot of the web and I think a lot of digital space is sort of subverted by this lack of real contract between the person that is looking at the thing and the people or person that's making the thing. On Twitter, for example, or Facebook, those things are just so nebulous. I don't know what the contract is. You know, it's like,
and that's constantly shifting too.
Constantly changing. You don't know what it's going to be the next day. But like a website like yours, to me, has a very clear...
Sorry,
Alexa was just yelling at me.
Conference her in. Talk about not knowing boundaries.
Exactly. Websites like yours, like you go to it and you know what you're getting and you know the edges of it and you can see where it left off the day before. There is a human scale to it, even though now it's super, super huge, that I think is beautiful and important and sustaining. If you were to take what you've done and you were to slice it and you had to make like a 400-page book, what would you pick? How would you do that? How would you think about going about that?
It's interesting when you talk about the, you know, you can see the boundaries of the thing. Like when I close my eyes, I can see exactly what a book would look like, you know, sort of the book version of Kaki.org.
Would it be yellow?
Yeah, exactly. You know, like I can see exactly what a conference, you know, if I put on a conference, like what that would look like.
Right.
Or a podcast. But, you know, specifically with the book, one of the titles I've always had sort of in the back of my mind is like the Kotke Almanac. Because, you know, like the site is so kind of eclectic.
Yeah.
And it's actually been interesting to, you know, I've been experimenting with email newsletters. Tim Carmody and I have started this newsletter called Noticing, which is basically him taking the week of posts that I've done on Kaki.org and sort of like making sense of them as a unit, which I had never thought about before. Like, I don't think about the site that way in sort of these week long chunks. I just think that, you know, this is an interesting thing. This is an interesting thing. And, you know, Tim has been going back and kind of chunking those things together into like, here's the three themes this week that Jason's been talking about. And I'm just sort of like, huh? Okay, sure.
Yeah.
I think that a book would probably be going back into the archives and looking at some sort of bigger themes that aren't maybe evident day to day, even to me.
Right.
Because I'm in the stream paddling as fast as I can. And, you know, right. I'm not standing on the bridge watching.
I think that would be incredible. I love the framing of Almanac.
Mm.
Because one of the things that you've been, if nothing else, is consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And to have that kind of consistency over such a long period of time means that you, in some way, whether consciously or not, you're mirroring the things that are happening in the world. You're mirroring the trends that are out there. And I think the framing of here are the trends, this is what was happening at this moment, and here are the sub tendrils. Here are the things I picked up that are connected with that, that maybe even the moment I didn't realize, but looking back on it, like, yeah, this influenced this, this led to this. You start to kind of draw these lines between things. That would be really fascinating, I think.
Yeah. And for the last, I don't know how many ever years, at least 8 or 9 years, I've been tagging all the entries with tags.
Yep.
And so the easy thing to do would be to go back and just, you know, group things together by tag.
Right.
But I think a better way to do it would be to group things together by, you know, like one of the things I talk about often is like, here's what people can do. Like, people are amazing. They can do all of these amazing things. And like, that's sort of a theme that runs through a lot of what I post, even though it's always sort of below the surface. I never call that much attention to it.
Right.
But, you know, that's one of the things that could be, you know, a theme in a potential book, I think.
Right. Even just something simple like, you know, the world according to Kaki.org or something like that. You can almost imagine the design of it where like facing pages have a screenshot of some website. You know, you could break it down by like every 2 weeks you choose one thing and you go through 10 or 20 years of 2 week, you know, here's this one thing from this 2 week period. Here's this one thing from this 2 week period, you know, and you have these screenshots. And so you have this super strong visual component on the right side. And on the left, you have the text breakdown of what that was. And then you kind of have, you know, dates running on the bottom or whatever. And even just that, because I think one thing that physical objects do really well is it lets us experience, say, for example, a span of 20 years, experience 20 years of web design, like looking back over those 20 years and seeing, even just being able to flip through it and see how, you know, websites have changed so drastically during certain periods. I don't know how you get all the screenshots. I guess archive.org, you'd have to lean on a lot, but
that would be the hard part. And also like blowing them up to book size.
I think that messiness is okay. You know, it's like what you could even do is print them in the book at real size. So like, as you go through, as you go through time, they get bigger, right? Because
bigger and bigger, right?
Yeah, because the resolution goes up or whatever. So
yeah. And then when you get responsive, it's like full bleed, like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You like, that would be kind of funny.
That'd be pretty neat. Anyway, it just feels like there's a lot to play with there, but more importantly, it would let you hold this thing, you know, that I was going back through your redesigns over the years. And I was having like these emotional moments, you know, because, because, you know, I first found you through Oscillate and then obviously Kaki. And I was looking at those designs and there's something so specific about the way they look and the design language they're using. And it's so strong. I think I remember when I saw them for the first time, it had such an impact on me, just sort of the intensity of the colors or whatever, that I remember who I was at that time. You know, these designs have a place in my heart in the same way that a familiar corner in a city has a place in my heart. You know, there's this weird emotional resonance connected to those images, to those points in digital space. You know, it's almost overwhelming looking back over them because, you know, you start to remember who you were and who you wanted to be at that moment. And I think there are very few things online where many of us who today have been working in this medium for decades can look back and feel that about as still existing. And so to somehow transmute part of that into an object you can hold feels intuitively like there's value there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I look at old designs of mine and also, you know, designs for other sites, I have those reactions as well. That sense of nostalgia and, you know, like every time I did a redesign, it was a very conscious choice. It was like, oh, the old thing is, it's looking old and I need something new to, you know, to tell, You know, in some cases it was like, I want to tell new types of stories using new kinds of posts, right, using a different font or, you know, whatever, to make sure that what I'm saying is presented properly. And it's funny, like the site has changed a lot, but in other ways, like the designs that I had, like they each stuck around for a while. Right. Like it was each 2 years here, 3 years here, 4 years here. Each is anchored in a moment.
Right. And in a presence of a certain kind of web technology too.
Right.
It's like, you know, when video starts taking off, you have to go, all right, well, how do we bring videos to this page in a way that, you know, that works?
Right.
Or, you know, oh, if everyone's reading on a mobile phone now, I noticed, I think it was in 2012, you said, well, you know, 40% of all the reading happens on a phone. I want to make sure that that looked better. But I think, you know, blogging with a capital B was as much about messing around with technology and responding to technology as it, and, you know, giving us excuses to redesign, you know, as it was and is about sort of the content in a way. You have this really kind of cute note on your 2016 redesign edition where you're really excited about the footnotes. You know, it's like, I was looking at that and I was just thinking, yeah, I would spend 2 weeks refactoring and redesigning and rebuilding everything for a better footnote. You know, it's like,
oh, yeah.
I get that. That's a certain kind of ethos of engaging with this medium.
I spent so long on how those footnotes should work and look. And now I don't like them. Like, I think they should work a completely different way.
How should they work?
I haven't figured it quite out yet because I haven't actually like popped into Sketch and tried fiddling around with actual design. But like in my head, it should just be a different type of link that is, you know, like you click on it and it pops up right there. Hmm. Instead of like a numbered button or, you know, whatever. I think I have like a pink circle with a plus sign in it now. It's too distracting when you're reading.
Huh.
I want to minimize the distraction.
Okay. I like the inline-ness of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Like you're not like jumping around.
But I also miss, you know, what's kind of fun with footnotes is you get to the bottom and you read them all at once. Mm. And then you go back. It's almost like dessert. It's like content dessert.
Right.
Obviously, you're a big David Foster Wallace fan.
Yeah. It's funny. I was just going to mention that because I found this news article today. It was Switzerland is banning cooking live lobsters because it's inhumane. And of course, you know, David Foster Wallace wrote a story called Consider the Lobster for Gourmet Magazine in 2004 about this very thing, you know, and it goes on for pages and pages. And so sort of inspired by that, I downloaded the Consider the Lobster audiobook. You know, he made a collection out of a bunch of his, you know, narrative nonfiction. It was called Consider the Lobster after that story.
Right.
And I started listening to it and the footnotes in the audiobook, what the, you know, sort of the audiobook people decided on is that he would speak in a normal voice for the normal text. And then they would modify his voice into like sort of a deeper voice when he did the footnotes. And it's completely ridiculous. Because you're listening along and all of a sudden it's just like his voice changes and you know, you're in a footnote, but it sounds crazy because some of the footnotes are like 3 or 4 minutes long.
Right.
And he's talking in like this voice that's not his voice. Right. Instead of just saying like at the beginning, like footnote and then end footnote.
Or like you could imagine, you know, putting like a tin phony, like telephone, old timey telephone filter over it or something, you know, where.
Yeah. It's so distracting though, because like his footnotes are, they're part of the main text. You know what I mean? They really are.
They're only footnotes because like he couldn't get away with, you know, filing a, you know, a 20,000 word story. So he files a 10,000 word story with 10,000 words of footnotes, right?
Right. Exactly.
There's kind of that element to it. Anyway, so I like the inlineness of footnotes when they work that way, but I also like having the collection at the bottom to reward myself with if I make it through a big piece. Because usually the footnotes,
right,
the footnotes are like where the true voice comes out. That's what I find. Mm-hmm. Even for me, when I'm writing a big thing and I have footnotes, it's like there's a tension in the main body of text. And then when I get to the footnotes, it's like, oh yeah, God, this is the casual corner. This is where I can kind of let my shoulders relax and, you know, I should probably be bringing that feeling to the main text too, but.
Exactly. I mean, what's funny about my site and, you know, a lot of blogs is that I am writing in a sort of casual corner all of the time. It's always sort of, you know, I write how I talk, but the footnotes somehow are even more so than that.
Right.
Which is weird.
It's totally arbitrary. You know, it's not like, you know, real footnotes live at the back of a book, you know, half the time. They're off the page. So they really do feel like their own little universe. But on the web, you know, there is no main and sub or whatever. It's all, especially when you're a robot, it's all the same.
And I feel like I'm using them less now because when I do want to include one, I'm like, wait a minute, I should just
say this.
You know, I should just incorporate this into the main text because that's where I should be using this sort of tone anyway.
Yeah, I use it as like, okay, well, actually, I want this paragraph to be four times as long, but that's not fair to you. And so the TLDR is here. And then if you want more, it's down below. It's about finding that balance. But voice is so important. And I guess of the 20 years of Kaki.org, obviously 9/11 was an intense political moment.
Mm-hmm.
And where were you in terms of this project when that happened? And how did you respond to that? Do you remember?
Yeah, I mean, I was a little more than 3 years in of doing the blog. And I was kind of doing Kotka.org and Oscillate at the same time as personal projects. And Kotka.org was definitely taking more and more of my attention just because, you know, blogging was kind of taking off. And I was like, hey, all these other people are doing this thing. I want to like, you know, it was really about exploration a lot. It was about like, oh, there's this new kind of way people are expressing themselves kind of in this distributed conversational way. And I really was interested in exploring that. Yeah. And then 9/11 happened. I was living in San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
I was not in New York at the time. Right. Living in San Francisco. And, you know, well, by the time I woke up and, you know, sat down on my computer,
it had all happened.
Yeah. I just left a job. I mean, I was laid off like everyone else I knew then because it was 2001 in San Francisco. And so, you know, nobody I knew had a job. I didn't have a job. And, you know, woke up and got on the computer. And I think the, you know, the first tower had already fallen.
Mm.
And everyone was freaking out, of course.
Right.
And, you know, I just sort of started doing the bloggy sort of thing, which is like, oh, people are posting all sorts of cool stuff. I'm going to start a post linking to all of that stuff.
Right. Right.
And, you know, I did that and was basically like on the computer all day, pretty much, you know, with minimal breaks. And just posting stuff like photos and maybe even like snippets of video. Like, I don't think I was hosting the video, but I was posting to other, you know, this was pre-YouTube, of course. Probably these QuickTime videos that were, you know, 320 by, you know, whatever.
You know, we all took down CNN.com.
Right, exactly. Like
CNN couldn't even handle it.
Yeah, sites were going down left and right. And, you know, that was part of the thing is like, you know, I was in these chat rooms on AIM and probably ICQ as well.
Sure.
And people were talking about like, oh, I mirrored this thing here. I mirrored this thing here. And it was really sort of this, you know, it was like an early moment of this sort of distributed, you know, I'm not going to call it journalism, but it was this distributed, like, how do we get this information out to people sort of thing, you know, which is what journalism is at its base, you know, and it was taking in a lot of different, you know, like, okay, like how do we help? Okay. Red Cross, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. And it was really incredible.
And then now we're in this other kind of political moment that is almost the polar opposite of that, in that it's not contained. It's infinite. Mm-hmm. You know, in your interview with the Nieman Lab, you know, you said it seems like in terms of other media outlets, it's been hard to cover anything but things that are serious. And then you say for Kaki, you know, I think that the site is much more about things that are a little bit more, you say, I don't want to say hopeful, but a lot of it is like, you know, look at this cool thing. How do you see Kaki existing in this current political climate?
It has nothing to do with the news or not a whole lot to do with the news. Like I'm more interested in sort of the broad trends. And I don't know. I think 9/11 is an interesting thing because I think something started there that has not yet ended and won't end for a long time. And it's not just, you know, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And, you know, we've been in Afghanistan for I don't know how many years now. I mean, since 9/11. The role of the U.S. in the world changed. And I think the way that the U.S. thought about itself changed on 9/11. And I don't think we've entered any sort of new moment where that identity has shifted dramatically.
Right.
I think a lot of our politics since then has been in either direct or indirect reaction to what happened on 9/11.
Right. Well, I mean, just, you know, in your comments about the role of media, everything is so serious and everything is doom and gloom in a way, you know, and the reason I asked, I mean, obviously I know you, do some political posts, mm-hmm. but there is this tenor of kind of existing in another plane, like Kaki.org is existing in this, in somehow like a more graceful space, probably in part because you're not driven by clicks. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not trying to clickbait folks. You're not putting out, as you said in that interview, 60 things a day, machine gunning, scattershotting, hoping that, you know, you make the page view chart go up and to the right. So that way the news organization can continue with ad dollars or whatever, you know, like there's a gracefulness that's happening there, which I think is fantastic. I think it's really important. It's probably why, you know, in some ways, Kaki.org today feels weirdly like the freshest it's ever been in 20 years. I don't know if you feel that way, but it's subversive in a number of ways. So it's subversive because it's a standalone website. That feels like its own protest. Yeah. You're not on Medium. You're not on Facebook. You know, you are your own thing. You own your island. You know, you're a landowner mm-hmm. on the web.
Right.
And that there's a sense of hopefulness. And it feels like today being hopeful is a form of protest. And that's a totally, totally acceptable form of protest that I think mm-hmm. sometimes gets thrown under the bus. And then on top of that, you have memberships. Let's talk about that for a second.
All right.
You had this website for 20 years and you just launched memberships a year ago.
Right.
Part of that was because the deck was folding.
Mm-hmm.
Since you've launched those memberships, like how has that changed your relationship with the website? And have the memberships been greater or lesser than you expected? And what's the experience been with those?
Going back to like when I started doing the site full time in 2005, I quit my web design job and I was like, okay, I'm going to do this full time. Yeah. And I actually launched it with, I called it the micro patron drive, you know, it was sort of this PBS style pledge drive, like, oh, like, you know, donate $30 and I'm going to do this full time for a year. And if I get enough money and enough momentum and whatever, like I'll continue doing it. And what was interesting about that is that it didn't, on my end, like the financial stuff was fine. I got enough money to actually make it into, this is actually a job that I'm getting paid for.
Yep.
But the way I felt about it was not great. I felt like I had 1500 people who were my boss, you know, and that was totally from my perspective.
Mm.
None of the people who had donated or contributed were saying like, you know, oh, you're not posting enough about this or you're doing this and not enough of this or whatever. Like nobody was complaining about that. It was all sort of in my brain. And, you know, at the end of the year, I was like, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to put ads on it. And, you know, that's what I did. And for, you know, 10, 12 years, like that totally worked. And then the last few years, I've been wondering, you know, with the rise of sort of Patreon and, you know, Kickstarter and all that sort of stuff, like people have gotten used to the idea of contributing to these projects that they care about, that they want to see exist in the world.
Yeah.
And so I started thinking again, I was like, okay, maybe I should do this membership thing. And I launched it and it did way better than I thought it was going to.
Right, right.
You know, it was kind of ridiculous. Like I had this range of what I thought and it blew past the high end of the range like 2 days in.
Right.
You know, and I was like, holy crap.
Yeah.
And now it's been going for, you know, almost a year and a half. And, you know, I've got to say, like, I do the site for a lot of different reasons. Like, it's interesting to me. I like doing the work. I feel really lucky to be able to sit down in a chair every morning and just sort of learn all day. You know, I get to read all of this stuff and write about it and all of these interesting things. But I also like doing it for, you know, the people who are paying me to do it, who have contributed and who have, you know, entrusted their hard-earned American dollar and also, you know, dollars from all over the place, actually. I really feel a sense of commitment to them that is really positive for me.
Right.
It's not like it was, you know, 10, 12 years ago where I felt it was sort of this thing that was a negative thing. Now it's a very positive thing. It's something that propels me.
Right.
Which is great. I love it.
Well, I think the normalization of paying for stuff has changed. You know, like in 2005, there was no real easy way to kind of do a web payment. It was just PayPal.
Yeah.
I think I have this vague recollection of that drive back in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when you launched the memberships, you know, a year and a half ago, my first reaction was, holy shit, am I not giving this thing money? It's like, why? Like, wait a minute. Wow, wait, I should be giving this thing money. Why am I not doing this? Like, yeah, obviously. I think a lot of us felt that way. It was this realization, like, I think we understand the brittle nature of our institutions a little more than we ever have.
Yep.
These things we love in the world are not in this world unless we continually put energy into them and supportive energy into them. And I think we felt that really strongly in the last 2 years, especially.
Yeah. Well, I think we've seen how things like advertising and things like shareholders can twist these services that we have loved into things that aren't looking out for our best interests.
Right.
And, you know, membership type things can do that as well. They can tweak incentives in a way, but I think they're much more likely to tweak them in a positive way than in a negative way, maybe. Maybe that's just a belief. I don't know.
Well, no, I think it's true. It formalizes an already sort of implicit pact. You know, I think that formalization of a contract that was already kind of implicit between your readers and yourself, I think that's a good thing for everyone. Well, I was talking with a friend about pricing prints for a gallery show. He's like, well, I don't want to overcharge. And I'm like, but yeah, but if you charge an amount that makes people think, the relationship they're going to have with that thing they buy is going to be so much greater than if it's like a $5 thing, you know, and they just go, well, I'll buy it. But if, you know, they pay $200 for the print, they're going to do something special with it. And so anyway, I think a lot of us in the world feel like our institutions that we love need to be supported. And obviously the easiest way to do that is to give money.
Yeah.
This is the moment to ask for these things if you're in the position that you're in. But then also, like you're saying, it dovetails into the content that you can focus on. I don't think all of these media outlets that are focused on so-called serious stuff all the time, I don't think they're doing it because they feel like it's, oh, this is for the best interest of our readership. You know, I don't think reading 10 articles a day about how everything is falling apart helps anyone, really, without actionable items. You know, and so being able to disconnect from that cycle, even though those are the things that people are going to click on, I think is important. You know, and that membership even feels like a subversion of what's happening in the world today. Asking for memberships as opposed to aligning yourself with some kind of ad network or whatever.
A membership for a blog that's 19 years old and wants to last for another 19 years as a blog, like, that's kind of crazy. Like, I'm not sure I would recommend anyone else, you know, going that route, but like, I don't know. It feels like the right thing to do. It feels like it will be around for another 19 years somehow.
And that's what I mean. Like, today, Kaki.org feels more vital than ever. It feels more alive than I think it's ever been. I was iterating through those points before, but, you know, another one is the mailing list, which I think is great. I mean, like, I love how we're all obsessed with mailing lists now. Again, it's like 1984.
Email is still a thing, man.
It's the vinyl of the internet, you know, but I think for good reason, because again, you know, you open Facebook, you don't know what the hell contract you're entering into.
Yep.
You open email, you get it. You understand this thing is going to end. As false as it may be, the inbox is a place of implied intimacy. You know, where you can have an even stronger voice than you can on the open web. And I know for me, writing stuff to my mailing list is probably the most satisfying thing I do online, to be honest. You know, and the responses I get are unlike responses you can get anywhere else on the web, I've found.
Right.
You know, who, you know, you're not going to get a 3,000 word comment from the heart posting on a news site or something like that.
Right. I mean, not anymore.
No.
I mean, but, you know, blogs used to be that way a little bit. One of the ways I've always thought about blogs is like you're writing an email to anyone who might be interested rather than a single person.
Sure, yeah.
And I think that, you know, blogs very much used to be like that. It was, we were all writing these open emails to each other and anyone who wanted to respond at length could.
Well, because we felt it was a safe space.
Yeah.
It felt intimate. There was an intimacy there in those networks. Right. You know, the world hadn't figured it out yet.
Right.
There was no Beyonce.horse yet. That was coming later. The confluence of all the things I think that are happening on Kaki.org right now, leaning on the mailing list, which is phenomenal, by the way. I think it's so good. And I think Tim is such a great partner for it. And again, it's about voice. You know, it's like Tim has that voice. Like, I look at those mailing list mails and I just think that would take me whatever, you know, whatever Tim just wrote would take me like a month to write. You know, the fact that he's doing that every week. Also using the mailing list as a place to, not to make it coldly commercial, but as a place to sell things. Sustainability is critical, right? We all want things that we love in the world to continue. And so they need to be sustainable. And like, I've just found for me, like my mailing list, there's no other place in the world where I can say, you know, hey folks, I need help with this thing. You know, or I launched this project. Can you support it? And then just instantly the support comes in like this way that's so moving. But between your mailing list and the memberships and the subversive nature of being like a handcrafted blog in 2018, it feels like, yeah, man, Kaki.org is more vital, more important than ever. And that's exciting, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's great to hear if it's true. I hope it's true.
I mean, how do you feel?
I mean, I feel like I've been working hard on it.
You have.
You know, I had some sort of difficult life changes in the last 3-4 years. Right. And I feel like I finally, you know, in the last couple of years, I finally had some time and energy to really kind of knuckle down and sit down and think about where this thing should go and what I want my role to be going forward and, you know, new things I could do. I think I've been hitting it hard.
Mm.
I hope it's having an effect.
I think it is. And I think that it shows in the membership interest and connection and just this remembering of how vital a singular curious voice in the world can be, you know, and how necessary that is sometimes. I'm able to type in KO in my web browser and it auto-completes to Kaki. And you kind of go to this familiar place that keeps evolving over time, but, you know, everything is connected through the strength of your voice and your ethos and your curiosity. And I think, you know, that's a very important, amazing thing to have in the world today. So thank you for doing that.
Those are very kind words, Craig. Thank you.
Well, they're true. I do think you should think about the book. I know that running the website alone is a lot of work, but I think even if you don't do it, the exercise of kind of touching that world might be instructive.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the idea of the almanac. So I hope you'll consider it. Let me know if I can help in any way. You can print it in Japan if you want. It'll be really expensive.
Awesome.
But thank you for taking time today and happy birthday. Happy blog day. Happy blog birthday.
Yeah, yes. And thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. And man, I think I speak for everyone on the web when I say we hope we see and continue to read Kaki.org for another 20 years.
All right. I'll see what I can do about that. Thanks, Craig.
Thanks, Jason. Bye-bye. Thank you all for listening. You can always email me at me@craigmod.com if you have any comments or especially if you have suggestions for future guests. I'm always looking for interesting book-related folk just outside my radar. And as always, there is a transcript of this episode online, as there is of every episode, at craigmod.com/onmargins. Today's episode was sponsored by a very special group of physics geeks in the heart of Geneva, solving tough problems and building giant slingshots underground beneath supermarkets and schools and police stations. If it wasn't for a cadre of curious geniuses, this episode would not exist, nor would trillions of dollars in market cap for most of today's companies. So, a big thank you to the tireless geeks of Geneva. Our heart goes out to you. Until next time, I'm Craig Maude, and this was On Margins.